Our commentator today is Susan Carol Rogers. Susan Carol Rogers is an associate professor of anthropology at New York University. She's held numerous posts, visiting posts in France. She is the author of an extraordinary number of articles. I lost count at 35, but I think it goes north of that figure. She's edited several volumes and has penned two monographs, the latest of which is entitled Shaping Modern Times in Rural France, the Transformation and Reproduction of an Aveyronnais Community. Please.
Thank you very much, and thanks especially to the panelists for a really interesting and stimulating set of papers. I have to say, as an anthropologist interested in agricultural development in contemporary France, I found these forays into past efforts to shape and manage the environment to be especially thought-provoking. My comments are suggested by these papers, but they really have more to do with ideas that occurred to me as I read them for things that I'd be interested in seeing elaborated in longer versions of the paper. We're all quite aware of the limitations of the 10 pages. So I'd first like to note at the outset, as Joseph reminded us, that Brodel's legacy clearly weighs heavy on environmental history generally, and all the more so in the Mediterranean. I think it's undoubtedly the case that no one would dispute the importance of the longue durée in understanding various dimensions, various environmental dimensions of French history. But these three papers draw our attention usefully, it seems to me, to the kinds of insights to be gained from a focus on shorter-term events and interventions, insights about the history of human efforts, here especially in the form of state interventions, to manage or shape natural environments, as well as the limitations on such efforts. That comes through clearly. One familiar argument that's most forcefully developed in Cindy's paper, alluded to in Joe's and present more in the breach in Joshua's, is the notion that one important indicator or vector of state formation or the consolidation of state power has to do with the effectiveness with which it intervenes in the natural world, or at least with people's expectations or acceptance that it will or should intervene. And certainly the French example of a highly centralized and powerful state as it emerges during the period of interest here provides really interesting case material for that. But I would like to sound a cautionary note here about generalizing too hastily from the French example. I think we need to be a little careful about pushing too far to the edges the possibility of other kinds of agents besides a powerful centralized state that may account for substantial human interventions in the environment, either in the absence of such a state or in addition to it. So I'm a little skeptical, and this may be my anthropology popping out here, but a little skeptical about trying to trace a general history of human interaction with the environment that's too tightly or inevitably bound to the history of the state. Anyway, I think so that's kind of the direction that I want to move my comments in. Now, Cindy, I'm going to go out of order a little bit, but Cindy makes an interesting and compelling case with respect to the plague sweeping across Provence in the early 18th century, and she shows us that the central state has, by this moment, acquired the power, the resources, and the legitimacy to intervene with respect to imposing quarantines and other public health measures, as well as relief efforts. And what's interesting to me is that the novelty here isn't so much what they're doing as the fact that they're displacing local or regional authorities in doing it. And she makes a very persuasive case that episode marks a telling moment in the consolidation of a centralized state power in France. My guess is that that history isn't really an unbending linear march in a consistent direction, even in France, but the kind of tracking of who is expected to intervene how in the context of natural disasters seems to me a really interesting focus that she draws our attention to, not only in the case of the history of the French state, but also, as she suggests, more broadly. The broader question she poses is intriguing, but again, I'm a little skeptical about the prospects of constructing a kind of universal history here. I'd be more cautious about generalization, even to the rest of Europe, from France, than she seems to be suggesting. I'm not so sure that there's anything specifically or generally modern or Western about the expectation that a powerful centralized state could or should be an appropriate counter to nature run amok. Rather, it seems to me that it's really worthwhile to ask where, when, and under what conditions are people inclined to look to a centralized state, to centralized state agencies for such intervention? And by the same token, when, where, and under what conditions do other forms of salvation seem more plausible, more legitimate, or reliable? So when are people more inclined to look to spiritual answers or foreign powers? I'm thinking here, not to be anachronistic, but in the case of the Haitian earthquake, it seemed perfectly normal and expected and totally legitimate to get help from foreign sources, whereas in the case of Katrina, it was deeply humiliating and embarrassing that anybody would suggest that we needed any kind of foreign aid. Or where is non-governmental aid or commercial considered legitimate and reliable? And there I want to ask, who exactly are the we that gets referred to in Cindy's paper? We expect the central state or whoever. I suspect that we're not talking about human beings everywhere, but that it's that it's much more specific to particular places and times. Anyway, it seems to me that whether we're looking at the 18th century or the 21st, the question posed by Cindy is an interesting one. But again, I'd suggest that it might be short-circuited if we assume some kind of universal linear progression or the inevitable centralized state. Now, the other two papers focus more on episodes that remind us of some of the limits of human intervention in the environment. Although Joseph, again, evokes the idea that human intervention in the environment increases with the consolidation of a centralized state. And I'd be a little cautious about that. The notion that the centralized state is necessarily more privileged agent than others in this matter. He's also suggesting, though, another kind of caution that seems to me well taken here, namely that the forces of nature don't necessarily submit readily to even exceptionally powerful states or sophisticated expertise. And I think that's a lesson that we are continually having to be reminded of into the present day. He provides an interesting example of the attempt to introduce cotton production to southern France, and noting that it rested on a strongly held belief in the human capacity, armed with sufficient scientific knowledge and political will, to shape the natural environment. And again, it's really interesting to see that idea so forcefully present in the historical period he's talking about, because it's not really an unfamiliar idea in the present day, I would say. So in this case, he's focusing primarily in this paper, he's focusing primarily on the motivations and interventions of Napoleon's regime, and arguing very compellingly that the particular effort he's describing to turn southern France's agricultural resources to cotton production was clearly driven largely by geopolitical interests, And the same can be said for the abandonment of the effort by the restored Bourbon regime 6 years later. It was equally driven by geopolitical interests. But he suggests that in the paper that this experiment also depended on convincing landowners in the area to put their resources to new uses. And there, presumably, although it's not developed in this particular version of the paper, but there's presumably a whole array of interests and motivations that associated with agricultural decision making that come into play, and that clearly were not fully controlled by even a very powerful state. Okay, so that the decision in the end, the decision of certain landowners to produce cotton or not to produce cotton, presumably were not driven primarily by geopolitical interests, but by some other kinds of interests that merit more attention than he had room for in this paper. I find that idea of the essentially what's happening here is that the use of kind of demonstration plots of cotton production in an effort to persuade local landowners to adopt this new use of the environment evokes a very common practice in 19th century American agricultural production that's not always that successful. To bring about a change. And here you have the idea that of agriculture as a kind of spectator sport, where people make decisions based on what they observe going on around them, and that's very difficult to fully control or manage those kinds of decisions. So it seems to me, in a longer paper, it would be worth exploring those human constraints on state powers to manage the environment to add that in. It doesn't diminish the importance of the main point that was made ultimately in this paper, that's also certainly well taken, again, that nature doesn't readily or inevitably bow to even the most powerful or rational of human forces, right? But there's a kind of it's not only nature that's constraining what can happen here. Joshua's paper dealing with the curious case of Corsica comes at the problem in interestingly similar and different ways. Clearly, his example of Corsica is Corsica's strategic from the perspective of the French state because of its location. His paper also is primarily focusing on the kind of perspective of the state. And what we see, what he's trying to explain, is how come the state did not intervene in ways that might be expected and, in fact, can be observed in other parts of France at the same time. So the argument seems to rest on a kind of normative expectation that the French state ought to have managed and shaped Corsica's natural resources, and especially timber, in a way that was profitable, presumably to the state. And then he's posing the question, why didn't this happen? Now, one obvious answer is because it wasn't profitable to certain other actors, who, in this particular context, turned out to be more powerful than that powerful state. Okay, the state, whether it's the French state or the other powers coming earlier, seem continually to be stymied by the local forces and their perspectives of their interests in how to use this natural environment. There's at least an implicit reference here to the idea that forest management was really a key piece of state formation in 18th and 19th century France. A number of people have made that argument quite persuasively. But again, it's another domain that's shaped by sharply competing interests between the crown, between local elites, between local peasants, each of whom have different ideas about legitimate and profitable ways of using, in this case, forest resources. What seems notable about the Corsica case, if I understand it correctly, is the absence of much active intervention on the part of the French state or the British or Genoese to shape or exploit that forest or other natural resources. There's a number of proposals made, but very little action is apparently. So that, again, the preferred uses by local populations seem to persist relatively unchallenged. I would be interested in seeing more attention to the various interests and forms of profit that appeal to the different players that might provide a more satisfying example to the question of why the dog didn't bark in the end, right? But in any case, one point to be taken from this case is, again, the limits of state powers and also of state interests in dealing with natural resources. That's, I think, what this case adds. The state interests seem to have been defeated by local interests here. It also draws attention to the variable value of particular resources as you move from one context to another. We're used to hearing about how crucially important timber was in 17th and 18th century France, but it's perhaps not absolutely so. The Corsican context gives us an example where the absence of infrastructure made timber of limited value, at least from the perspective of the state. It's also a case where presumably the costs of developing that infrastructure were outweighed by the perceived benefits, again from the perspective of the state. So it draws attention to the shifting contexts that are going to change the meaning of these particular natural resources. All three of these papers, and Joshua's in the breach, offer specific episodes that provide, I think, really interesting tools for thinking about the history of state efforts to manage and control the natural environment. Again, the France of this period is a terrific case for exploring that issue. But I would like to see in more elaborated developments of this wonderful material a little more attention to the example of a strong state as one among other kinds of agents acting on the environment, and a little more attention made to the notion that even where there is a strong centralized state as an important player, it's likely to be working in concert with or in competition with other kinds of human agents. It seems to me that this set of papers would be even further enriched by a little more attention to that side of the equation. So I'd like to stop there.